Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're headed outside during the 9 o'clock hour to get a look at what reptiles and amphibians are on the move. At 10, we'll take a trip to the Vermont company that is the largest cookie cutter manufacturer in the U.S. And we'll finish up by getting ready for baseball season with some stories from Addison County Independent sports columnist Carl Lindholm. But let's begin by learning all about herpetology with Jim Andrews. He's the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. Jim, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure on our side as well. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask Jim a question about amphibians or reptiles, or to let us know what you've seen so far this year, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jim, I always like to make sure we know our herpetology before we get too far into it. So help us understand the difference between reptiles and amphibians.
Well, first let me point out that a herpetologist does not study herpes.
That's right.
I have had people make that mistake.
Yep.
But reptiles, amphibians. The reptiles we have are the snakes, the turtles, and our one lizard. We only have one species of lizard. And then the amphibians are the frogs and the salamanders. The frogs and the salamanders have a smooth, moist skin, and they have to stay moist or they're going to dry out and die. And they will do that in a couple hours if they're out in the sun and they don't have moisture in the ground. And that's why most of them are undercover most of the time, and that's why most of us have to get out after dark in a rainy night to see them move.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reptiles, they can get right out and bask in the sun, and they don't have to worry any more than we do about drying out. Scaly skin, lay eggs with shells on them so they can travel quite a ways away from water. Those are kind of the basic differences. There are others, but that's the starting point.
And, they seem different enough, so why do we group them together under herpetology?
Well, that's kind of just history. There's no really good reason to put them together. I guess it was just kind of an everything else category. People do the mammals and the birds and the fish and then...
those guys.
Everything else, yeah. All those creepy crawlies they threw together because they're not all that closely related.
Oh, interesting.
No.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to be the ones to separate them. We're going to keep them together on a show.
Okay.
So
you know what I ought to throw in, Rick,
just to keep please.
Keep people on their toes, is that we really now know that birds are reptiles, too. But even though we know birds are reptiles, herpetologists don't study birds. we know that because we have eventually figured out for sure that the birds – evolved from some of the dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs were definitely reptiles. So birds are just warm-blooded, feathery reptiles.
Wow.
But,
I love that.
We don't try to claim them. We let the ornithologists stick with the birds, and we won't steal them from those guys.
Well, perfect segue, Jim, because tomorrow at 9 we're doing our spring migration bird show. So we'll do the other half of the reptiles with the ornithologist tomorrow.
There you go.
So done, Jim. All right. And why did this become kind of your field of study? Why were you really excited about these critters?
Well, I've been interested in anything alive really since I was a kid, wandering around in the woods. And I also grew up in the Vermont hunting and fishing tradition, kind of the rural tradition. And so I've been out in the woods a lot looking at whatever I could look at. But more specifically, it turns out, and I didn't realize this at the time, that my grandmother used to teach about snakes. And I never even knew my grandmother. But she passed that along, that interest and that comfort along through my mother.
Yeah.
who was kind of the local go-to snake lady. If some kid found a snake in the neighborhood, then it was Mrs. Andrews that you had to go see. And, of course, as a kid, you don't realize that and what influence that might have.
Right.
And then later on, I mean, I taught junior high science for a while here in Middlebury. Mm-hmm. And then I did, in the summers, I was doing field work. And then I realized, you know, I'd really like to do this field work stuff year-round, or at least as close to year-round as I can. I got to admit, reptiles and amphibians are pretty thin in the winter. But I figured out that nobody was really focusing on reptiles and amphibians in Vermont, and that we didn't have a complete list of what species we had, and there was a lot we needed to know in order to successfully protect what we have. So I just moved into that slot. And I could have moved into other slots because I had, you know, a really wide interest, as many people do, but I decided reptiles and amphibians was an area that really needed work, so I moved in.
Wow. Well, all the herptiles in the state, thank you for that. Because you have elevated them, you know, to a great field of study. Well, it is that time when they start to move. So what are we seeing, Jim, and why?
We're seeing a flood of activity right now. I can't keep up with my emails. I'm getting behind. You know, the first frog to show up in the spring is a wood frog. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's one of those freeze-thaw frogs, and we have four of them, that actually the fluids between the cells in their bodies actually freeze in the winter where they're huddled into the leaves, and their lungs stop and their heart stops. And then we start getting these first warm days in the spring, and they thaw out and head to the breeding ponds. And so they've been doing that. I was out earlier this week, Tuesday, and even at moderately high elevations, and I'm saying 1,000 feet or so in Lincoln, there were lots of wood frogs out in the ponds, covering the surface of the ponds and calling. They didn't spend the winter there. They spent the winter in the woods, but they have moved in. Many, many people are hearing the kind of the chuckling call. I can't do it, but
I get the idea.
Go online and listen to it.
Thanks for the effort.
Yeah, kind of duck-like, and many, many people are reporting that, particularly on these sunny afternoons, because they will call. Unlike some species, they will call during a nice, warm, sunny afternoon, and they'll even move sometimes during a sunny afternoon as long as the ground is wet. And so many people are reporting them, and we're looking at egg masses. We monitor at a couple sites. We monitor numbers of egg masses, and there are already over 100 egg masses in these many of these little small ponds. So the wood frogs, first of the frogs, definitely moved in, and I'm sure that there are other people out there who have started to hear their smaller relative, the spring peepers.
Mm-hmm.
And people are talking about that. The peepers calling from the ponds and the ditches that have grassy edges, because the peepers really like to have some grass or sedges or cattails or something to call from. So they like those kind of wetlands. They were up in the woods as well. People are hearing them. And then for those of us who have been getting out at night on those warm, rainy nights, and we had a great night. When was that? Last week, maybe Thursday. We had a great night where at one of the crossings, one of the major crossings that we're aware of here in the Champlain Valley, you know, in 2 hours we had close to 1,000 amphibians moving through. I mean, it's just quite a neat wildlife event, wildlife migration to see. It's really fun. Yeah. I mean, it's not like the wildebeest. I mean, you have to look a little closer. You have to look at your feet. But if you find a good spot, it's really fun. And you know, there were thousands where we were, because we know it's a major spot and we have public events there. But you don't need that. Anybody that has a little pond or a little vernal pool or beaver dam, you know, near their house could go out with a flashlight at night. And tonight would probably be a good night, as long as these rains materialize that are in the forecast.
Right.
and poke around, you know, on a small road near a pond or a vernal pool, or just go to the edge of the pool and you know, take a look at what's going on. And they might well see the big spotted salamanders, which everybody, that's our sexy megafauna.
They
that's our
beautiful.
PR representative, you
yep.
know. Big black salamander with yellow spots. They're moving now. Just a few of them have made it to the ponds already. They lay their eggs a little bit later than the wood frogs, but they're moving now. The other early movers have been moving for a while, blue-spotted salamanders, mm-hmm. beautiful black salamanders, but instead of having yellow spots, they have blue spots, and they're not as big as the spotteds.
A gorgeous shade of blue, those spots. Really
beautiful.
Neat.
Yeah, you've seen them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love them.
And there's some rarer stuff that we really would like people to report if they could see them, but they're small and they have to look carefully, like four-toed salamanders. We don't have a lot of information on the distribution of four-toed salamanders, and they're only about 3 inches long and they're skinny, and people are getting real excited about the big black and yellow ones. But you know, take a close look if you're out there. Take a close look at those little skinny ones and see if they have a bright white underside with black spots. Those are four-toed. If they have a bright white underside with, and they're fairly easy to turn over.
Mm-hmm.
The other little ones, the redback salamanders, are harder in heck to pick up and really squirmy and difficult to turn over. But four-toed are pretty easy to get your hands on. So,
all right, let's go to Newbury, and we've got Fred on the line. Fred, good morning.
Good morning. Hey,
good morning, Fred.
Interesting. My wife and I did a cross-country trip, about 4, 5, 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Took us 6 summers and 6 springs to do it. Anyways, we got to western Pennsylvania. We discovered the Allegheny Mountains. To bike through the Allegheny Mountains, forget it, you never make it through them, because you have to go up and down and around. So we found the Mid-State Trail, and we hiked the Mid-State Trail. And on the Mid-State Trail, we ended up at a place called the Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And I couldn't believe my eyes. I saw more rattlesnakes in Pennsylvania than ever in my life. And I've been, you know, through many states that have rattlesnakes in them. I just couldn't get over it. They were big black rattlesnakes. And when we were going through the mountains, we'd be walking on the rocks and you could hear the rattlesnakes right underneath us. And it was really amazing how I got used to rattlesnakes, and I just walked right over the top of them while they were under the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
We always carried a walking stick when we were on the trail, because we'd go swish, swish back and forth to make sure there were no mm-hmm. rattlesnakes.
Wow.
When it came to taking a rest on a log or a stone, we would go swish, swish all the way around it to make sure there wasn't any. But it was very interesting.
Yep.
And when I was in California, I saw a sidewinder. And a sidewinder is the weirdest snake you'll ever see, because the sidewinder can do two things. He can look right at you and go away from you, or he can look away from you and go right at you. And that's how he catches your animals, by looking away from them and then going right at them. It's really weird.
Yeah. Hey, Fred, thanks for bringing up rattlesnakes. I don't think we have any sidewinders here, but Vermont does have a colony of rattlesnakes, Jim. Tell us about that in one place, right?
Yeah, well, we actually have two areas where we still find rattlesnakes. I mean, historically, we had rattlesnakes at a number of other denning sites. One of the unfortunate conservation issues with timber rattlesnakes that has to do with their natural history is that rattlesnakes for miles around will, and by miles I probably mean 4 or 5 miles in each direction, will come back to a communal den. And so once early colonists figured out where those dens were, then they could be there at the den spring and fall and eliminate the snakes as they were coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
So many of those dens have disappeared. At least the rattlesnakes at the dens have disappeared. I mean, other issues have been roads. I mean, we've had busy roads, interstate 89, 91 that have gone close to those dens, and so the snakes, of course, that were basking on the roads would get killed. But so we've narrowed it down now to Rutland County.
Yep.
As the only place where we continue to get records of rattlesnakes. In two areas, a number of little portals within those areas, but only two areas where we can still find those snakes. And I suspect that's, when we're talking about Pennsylvania, I suspect that's what our caller was seeing as well, which are timber rattlesnakes. And as they get older, you might well be looking at some of them that were almost black. Because he did mention that some of them look solid black.
Yeah.
Heavy-bodied, generally slow-moving. Luckily for us, they're pretty docile. And I've even talked to a couple of my colleagues that have stepped on them by accident.
Mm-hmm.
These are people that were out looking for them. And neither of them got in trouble. The snakes were pretty tolerant of that. I wouldn't recommend trying it.
Right.
But one of them actually was just hitting the researcher on the leg with his head, just saying, you know, get the heck off me. Wasn't biting him, but just
right.
Get the heck off my body. And they'll usually rattle. If you get too close to them, they start getting nervous. They'll usually rattle, but they are just tremendously well camouflaged. And most of the time, you could walk within a couple feet of them and not see them. I suspect, just from what the caller said, that he was in pretty open, rocky, ridgeline areas,
mm-hmm.
and his timing was probably just about right for either they were just leaving the den, so they were still concentrated, because they'll spread out, you know, they'll spread out for a couple miles in every direction. So he probably was walking not too far away from the dens on those ridges, or maybe the females. Females have favorite birthing areas.
Oh, okay.
Where and they got to be sunny and exposed, where they'll hide under a rock and have their young. They give live birth, which some snakes do. Some of our snakes give live birth. Some of our snakes lay eggs.
Oh, gotcha.
But they give live birth, and they actually take care of the kids until the first time they shed. And they're the only snake we have that does that. Everybody else have the kids. Leave them alone. They're on their own.
You're on your own.
Yep.
Wow.
They're on their own. You know, we have to wait about 20-some-odd years before we can say that, but as humans.
But, that's right. How many rattlesnakes will be in a den, typically?
Oh, you could have 100 or more in a den.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have other species in a den. They could mix them up with rat snakes or milk snakes or other species that are used in the same den.
Hmm.
But another thing to keep in mind with rattlesnakes is that they're really, like the caller said, I mean, they're more common as you go further south and it's a little warmer. So they're at the northern extreme of their range.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get up here, the warmest areas we have, the warmest microclimates, would be relatively low elevation, rocky, like a solar collector, rocky open areas that are facing south or southwest to heat up. And so we have a limited number of those sorts of areas where we're extending our active season a few weeks, spring and fall, because of where they are in those warm, sunny areas. Of course, that's going to change now, and
yeah.
It's going to get warmer.
Right.
And who knows what that'll do? Possibly it's to the advantage of timber rattlesnakes, but don't make the mistake of thinking global warming is a good thing, because it's going to be a real challenge for lots of other critters.
Yeah. What do they do during the winter, those rattlesnakes, if they love sun so much?
Well, precious little. I mean, because they are ectothermic, I mean, the common term is cold-blooded.
Mm-hmm.
And most herpetologists don't like to use the term cold-blooded, because all summer they're going to try to be keeping their blood around 80 degrees.
Hmm.
And so it's not really cold. It's just solar heated. If you got sun, you're going to be keeping your temperature up there pretty good and warm, so that you can be efficient in healing and your eggs developing and digesting your food. But in the winter, when you get chilled down and your body temperature is maybe somewhere in the mid-40s, their whole metabolic rate is just almost to a standstill, and so they don't need the food. To begin with, they're much more efficient than we are. Let's say 3% of the energy use of a mammal the same size. If you think about that, I mean, if you and I, Rick, could live on 3% of the food that we use, 3% is pretty small.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when they're active. And so when they chill down in the fall for the winter, they don't need any food at all. So, for instance, these frogs and salamanders that are all popping up, they haven't had anything to eat in 7 months. And the same as with the snakes. I mean, they've just been still underground, kind of in cold storage, until, you know, the outside air started warming up. And then they started, first thing they'll do is come to the surface and maybe bask on a sunny day, but they'll go back in the den at night because they know it might get cold again. And then when it really starts to get warm, then they'll start spreading out when they feel safe.
Yeah.
They'll start traveling out for a couple miles.
I need to go on that diet. All right, we're going to take a break. We've got a full hour dedicated to Vermont's lizards, snakes, toads, frogs, salamanders, efts, and newts. Sorry if I left anyone out. We're taking a break now for CBS News. Then we'll return to hear more about the state's herptiles with Jim Andrews. Coming up today at 1, we've got 3 massive hours of The Getaway with Gallopin' Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. This is one of those wonderful times of year when hiking around your neighborhood and into the woods can provide an amazing show of nature. But to see the one we're discussing this morning, keep your eyes on the ground to see all the reptiles and amphibians that are getting active. Jim Andrews, the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas, is my guest until 10. And just to let you know, you can check out the atlas at vtherpatlas.org. And you can share what you've been spotting in your corner of the world or ask Jim a question, 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Jim, when we were talking about Vermont's rattlesnakes, you talked about, you know, some of the things that happened that caused the numbers to be really diminished. What are the biggest threats to herptiles and to all wildlife in Vermont?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. I mean, it's really pretty straightforward. If you look at our wildlife as a resource, like, for instance, you like eating venison or ruffed grouse or goose or something, populations should be able to handle that kind of harvesting successfully and persist as long as we have enough habitat for them. So that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
We need to maintain the habitat, healthy working ecosystems where these species can breed and have their young and raise their young and grow. And so we need the habitat. And then the second threat is habitat fragmentation, which is breaking habitat up into little pieces, smaller and smaller little scattered pieces. That makes it more difficult. Some species can't live in those pieces at all when they get that small because they have to travel. And what they have to travel for, maybe they can't get to. Maybe what they have to travel for is on the other side of Interstate 89, or it's on the other side of Burlington, or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
They have to be able to move around the landscape, and so we break it up into smaller and smaller pieces, it makes it harder for the wildlife to survive over the long term and reproduce. So habitat fragmentation. And then the last one, habitat again, but it's what we call habitat degradation. So we're doing, let's say we do something specific. Maybe it's a pesticide that we used on that piece of habitat. Maybe it's maybe we accidentally moved the emerald ash borer into that piece of habitat, and it killed all the ash trees. And then as a result, this had an effect on breeding amphibians in vernal pools, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's really habitat and the quality of habitat that is key. Now, in some cases, like the rattlesnakes, not only was it habitat, but there was something specific, and that was bounties. People didn't like rattlesnakes.
All
and
right.
So there was direct persecution of rattlesnakes. When they figured out where the dens were, they could go to the dens, they could kill them, and they could have a big impact. So in some cases, there's these other specific threats, like a wood turtle. A wood turtle has to feed on ground. You're better off, if you're a turtle, you're better off being an aquatic turtle, like a painted turtle, and spending most of your life in the water.
Mm-hmm.
If you're running around on land near a river, then you are much more at risk from, say, a car. Now, turtle shells have evolved to protect them from predators, but they have not evolved to protect them from a semi or a piece of farm equipment cutting a field.
Yeah.
So in some cases, there's these direct threats, but we should focus on habitat. And a lot of people understand that. I mean, you got the state of Vermont, the Nature Conservancy, many other organizations that are out there trying to conserve habitat.
Yep.
And you've got sports organizations like the Wild Turkey Association. Anyhow, there's turkeys, there's Ducks Unlimited, that are trying to protect habitat as well. Many people understand that. But it also now is because most land is privately owned. It's our responsibility as landowners to, if we want habitat to survive, then we need to learn how to coexist with these critters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get calls from people who don't want to have garter snakes around their house. I try to get people to understand that the garter snakes are no real threat, and we just have to learn how to coexist.
Absolutely. Hey, let's take another call. Mary's joining us from Randolph Center. Good morning, Mary.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Good morning, Jim. I don't know if you can answer this, but it sounds like you might be able to.
Okay.
I was walking the other day, and it was kind of midday, I guess, and I guess we had had some light rain or snow the night before, but the roadway was covered with earthworms or worms. I don't know
what
to call them. And I started picking a couple up, but then as I started walking, there were just, I mean, hundreds of them. And I just wondered why they come out and, you know, it's kind of the end of their life once they're dried up on the road.
Yeah, well, roads are the same threat to the earthworms. I mean, it's not something they evolved with. And they don't want to be on those roads. They're just moving around, and they got on those roads. And like an amphibian, earthworms will dry out really pretty quickly, and so if things got cold or dry when they were out and about, so then that was the real threat that might have killed them. And like you understood that, and you were moving some off. But when it rains, not unlike the wood frogs, these earthworms have been in the soil, and they come to the surface of the soil. And they start moving around and breeding, and some of them just get caught out.
Mm.
Let me point out, though, that not everybody realizes that all of our earthworms of the type that you were looking at are non-native.
Oh.
They were all introduced here. They were all brought here for either gardening purposes or fishing or other reasons, and recently some new earthworms have been introduced, and you may have heard about snake worms or jumping worms, very active worms that have been introduced here from Asia that behave kind of like little snakes, and yeah. they twitch and turn and move a lot, and they also stay in shallow soil. They don't go nearly as deeply, and so many people are seeing these new worms as well. But you're definitely right. They are certainly threatened by cars, by traffic. You know, maybe someday we'll move to hovercraft, Rick. You know, and we'll be able to get around without running stuff over. But so far, that's just not the case.
Yeah. How many reptiles or amphibians have disappeared from Vermont in recent years, Jim?
Well, you know, that's kind of a sad thing. I mean, reptiles and amphibians have a significant proportion of that particular those taxonomic groups that are either at risk because of the issues that we've talked about. They're either at risk or may have disappeared. We haven't found boreal chorus frogs, which, if most people saw it, they would think peeper. It's a little frog mm-hmm. with three stripes down its back. It doesn't have an X on its back. It has three stripes. And this one was in just northwestern Vermont, Grand Isle, of Franklin, Chittenden counties. And last person to see one of those in Vermont was Fish and Wildlife biologist Mark Ferguson in 1999, which is getting to be a while ago.
Yeah.
You know, 23 years.
Yep.
And they also disappeared from the Champlain Basin of New York State and from much of Quebec. Our friends in Quebec think that's a habitat loss issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely convinced that that is the only reason. I think something else, and I don't know what it was.
Introduction of a chemical or maybe a non-native species?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're on target there. Maybe introduction of a new chemical to farming mm-hmm. practices, because it's a lowland species, you know, mm-hmm. that often would be in farm ditches and that kind of stuff. Maybe a series of bad droughts, like a natural. You know how our weather has become more unpredictable?
Yes.
Maybe we had a series of dry spells during the wrong time of year. That was a real threat to them. Sadly, we don't know.
Yeah.
Racers, which is a snake in southwestern Vermont. We haven't seen a racer in about a decade now.
Hmm.
That's almost certainly a habitat loss and fragmentation issue, because racers cover 2 or 3 miles of territory as they travel.
Mm-hmm.
And for a big black snake like that to travel 2 or 3 miles without running into a road or a farm field where they might get hit by farm equipment or logging equipment, that's a challenge nowadays.
Sure.
2 or 3 miles is a long distance.
Wow. Jim, DJ wrote in, says we have a camp on a tiny lake in midsummer, in the spring and summer, we see the typical orange-spotted salamanders at the edges of the lake. We watch them through the clear water, and they come to the surface, then go back down and wiggle into the leaf matter. And so he has a few questions. Wants to know, where do they go in the winter? Do they lay eggs or have live birth, and where? Says, I assume they need to come to the surface for oxygen. So how long can they hold their breath? What do they eat, and what preys upon them?
Lots of good questions there.
Yeah.
Well, the critter is the eastern newt.
Mm-hmm.
And the eastern newt has kind of an interesting and unusual life cycle in that it's born in the water. It hatches out from an egg in the water. And then it emerges. They'll emerge in the end of the summer. And they will be kind of little purpley bronze, pretty dark. And only about an inch and a quarter or so when they first come out. But then they turn bright orange, and that's what people are used to seeing, kind of bright orangey-red with spots on them. And they even have a special name for that stage in their life, and it's called the red eft mm-hmm. stage of the eastern newt. And those red efts wander around on the land, and they can wander around on the land during the day, because they have a certain level of toxicity in their skin fluids. And so most of the daytime predators that would be a big threat to other amphibians, will learn after a mistake or two to leave them alone. But still, they're an amphibian, so the ground has to be wet. And so when people see these things, is maybe they're hiking in the woods, but the ground's still wet because it rained yesterday or the night before. The ground has to be moist. When that ground dries out, these guys have got to hide again, and so they hide under cover. Now, they'll travel around on land for a couple years, and that varies from site to site. In some places, that's as many as 7 years to travel around on land. But then they go back to the ponds, like your caller is asking about. Mm-hmm. They'll go back to the ponds, and they're changing color. And the timing of the color change is not always perfect. Sometimes they'll get back to the ponds when they're still red, reddish-orange. Sometimes they'll turn green before they get back to the ponds. But anyhow, they're going back to the ponds, and then they're going to spend the rest of their adult life in the water. Hmm. And they're going to, as your caller mentioned, they hide along the shallow margins of the ponds, and they'll hide under the leaves and the dead grasses and all that kind of stuff where you have, they particularly like it where you have grasses or cattails or some sort of emergent vegetation that they can hide in and feed in. So those adults will lay single eggs. They don't lay a mass.
Wow.
They lay lots of eggs, but they lay one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll attach one at a time to a plant stem somewhere. And then those are the eggs that mature over the summer and hatch over the summer, and then the little ones come out in the fall and go back onto land. So it's an interesting species that has evolved essentially along with beaver ponds, because beaver ponds, often beavers will move up and down a drainage or they'll move over into the next drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And so the adult population, their beaver dam will eventually rot. If they're not taking care of it, it'll rot and wash out. But all those little red guys, all those red Fs are wandering around, and when they mature, they'll drop into the new pond.
Nice.
So all wherever that new pond is.
All right, let's try to get – we got a couple calls waiting, so let's try to move on. Stuart joins us from Worcester. Hi, Stuart. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I joined the conversation late, so perhaps you've already mentioned this, but there's an excellent book about rattlesnakes by Ted Levin.
Oh, I love Ted.
Titled America's Snake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's published in 2016, so it's relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted is a local,
yep.
Either, you know, New Hampshire or Vermont, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just unreasonable fear of snakes, and particularly rattlesnakes. So we need to keep their habitat locations secret.
Mm-hmm.
And if people read this book, you know, they'll become reassured that they're not a threat.
Yep. Well said, Stuart. Thank you. Ted Levin's America's Snake. Love that. Let's go right to George in Middlebury. George, you're up next.
Hey, how you guys doing? I got a quick story about, I'm assuming they were spotted newts based on this story, but my daughter, when she was about 5 or 6, went with some friends over to Orange County to open up their camp. And there was a pond, and she came back, and when she came back, she was describing to me how her and her friend had saved all these salamanders that were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And they had basically taken these salamanders out of the water and separated them because they felt like the one on top was basically beating up the other one. And when I finally...
You got to keep your bedroom door closed, too.
She had this look on her face that was priceless when I explained what was going on. And I don't know if there was a population decline that year in that pond, but they had a lot of fun.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you, George. Well, let's talk a little bit, Jim, in the time we have left, about citizen scientists like George's daughter. How can people contribute to sightings that they have of these amphibians and reptiles?
Well, yeah, we're trying to fill in the gaps in our distribution maps for the state. And for some species, like I mentioned before, the four-toed salamanders or the racers or the very, very rare spotted turtles or things like that, it is tremendously helpful when people out there who are poking around, maybe they're canoeing or maybe they're just splitting firewood or something, and they find something under the wood pile. If they could just take a photo, and send us a photo along with the time and the place, you know, where they took the picture. And if even if they don't know what it is, we can, as long as they get a decent photo, we can tell them what they were looking at. And it might be a record that will help us fill in our distribution maps. Or maybe if we really get lucky, we find a new population of something particularly unusual. So all I need to do is go to our Herp Atlas website, and you gave them that vtherpatlas.org, and there's a form there where they can just fill out the form as what we just saw, and this is where it was, and attach a couple photos, and that can be tremendously helpful in filling in these distribution gaps.
Has there been anything, Jim, in the last few years that, you know, you haven't seen in a long time, or, you know, that you found that someone has reported?
Well, I mentioned a spotted turtle. A lady in southern Vermont mentioned a spotted turtle that she saw, I think it was on the edge of her driveway. We only know of three populations of spotted turtles in the state.
Hmm.
And so that is a tremendously important sighting. A different sort of a deal is that people over in the eastern part of the state are reporting water snakes from populations further north.
Oh.
Now, you know, is this climate change? You know, is this global warming? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe we just missed these populations. But so we've got a couple new populations that have popped up that have really been of interest to us. There's a snake, and this requires careful observation, but you know, 19 out of every 20 snakes that people see are going to be garter snakes. And that's really our most common and easiest to see species. But there's another lookalike called the ribbon snake that has a bright white lip on the face. And it has some other differences, too, all of which are explained on our website. But, you know, if people were to see these ribbon snakes, that would be tremendously helpful. We haven't seen any ribbon snakes north of Addison County, and they used to be in Chittenden County in decades.
Jim, we're going to have to leave it right there. But I think we need to do a snake show later this summer, so I'll invite you back.
Happy to do it, Rick.
Good. Jim Andrews is the coordinator of the Vermont Reptile and Amphibian Atlas. And to learn more of what we're discussing today, vtherpatlas.org. Jim, you make learning about these lovely little critters so much fun. Thank you for being on.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Yep. All right. Take care. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to make some cookies, kind of. We're going to use Ann Clark's cookie cutters made here in Vermont. Coming up tonight at 7, we've got 2 great hours of jazz with George Thomas. Then it's Eye on the World with John Batchelor from 9 to 1. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. So many family traditions take place in the kitchen. One is gathering around various holidays to do some baking, getting out the appropriate cookie cutters, firing up the oven, whipping up the batter, and baking treats. And many of the cookie cutters that become special to family members get handed down from one generation to the next. Now, did you know that the country's largest cookie cutter maker is here in Vermont? Ben Clark is the CEO of Ann Clark Cookie Cutters. He joins us now to share their story. Ben, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, great having you. Listeners, to ask Ben a question, or you can tell him about the Ann Clark cookie cutters you use, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint at RadioVermont.com. Ben, I have to clear this up right at the start. When I say you are the largest cookie cutter manufacturer in the country, does that mean you have created the largest cookie cutter in the U.S. or you create the most cookie cutters in America?
We create the most cookie cutters in America. We're pretty confident we're the largest cookie cutter maker in the world, but we can't prove it. So we know we're the largest in America by the number of cookie cutters we make.
I never would have guessed that we had the largest cookie cutter maker right here in Rutland, Vermont. I'm even more proud today of our state than ever. How and when did the business get started?
So my parents started the business back in 1989. My mom was an artist. My dad was a consultant and effectively bored. and the idea was to figure out how to mass produce some of the art my mom had created. They started, my mom drew this cute pig. So they had a pig cutting board and a pig Christmas tree ornament and a pig coaster. And they found a company to make cookie cutters out of it. So they had a pig cookie cutter. They took it to a wholesale trade show outside of Philadelphia and sold to a bunch of gift stores. And they sold. So then they came home. They dropped a couple products. They added a cow and a sheep. Took those to another show and they sold. And after about a year or two, it sort of all the other products went away and it became cookie cutters. And that became their business, is selling cookie cutters with a cute recipe card attached to them to gift stores all over the U.S.
Oh, my goodness. And the cookies, yeah. The cookies on your website, we'll get to it, but they're the most incredible cookies I've ever seen when they get decorated. So how many years was it before it became all Ann Clark cookie cutters?
Well, so at this point I grew up in Rutland and then had left after college and I wanted to come back here to raise my kids. Mm-hmm. So I called my parents and convinced them to let me join the company and spent a lengthy conversation convincing my wife to say, hey, let's move from Maryland back to Vermont. So we came back and I wanted to grow the company. So we just kept working at it. We kept getting better at we started making the cookie cutters as opposed to buying them. Mm-hmm. And the more we made, the better we got at it. We kept working at it to the point where we bought the company that we had been originally buying cookie cutters from.
Wow.
And that really opened the whole world up. That was a little over 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So now instead of just selling to gift stores, we're also selling to kitchen shops. And that's where the volume is. We're keep inventing ourselves. We're coming up with new machines and then making those machines better and keep, it's really how fast can you make the cookie cutters?
Right.
Then we hit the point with the machines that we run today that we can make a cookie cutter competitively costed with a cookie cutter coming from China. And that's when the game really changed. Then it became a marketing game.
Wow.
So supply, we were all on equal footing price wise. And then it's, can we outmarket everybody? And effectively, that's been our success.
And tell us about the materials that you use to make your cookie cutters.
So we, our big thing is everything is made in the United States. So we're buying steel from the U.S. and we source that from a U.S. steel supplier. It's tin-plated steel, which is what they make tin cans out of. So we source that. I don't think we buy 80,000 pounds at a time. It's slit to our specifications, and that's what we're making cookie cutters out of.
As a kid who grew up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and whose father worked in the Bethlehem Steel Mill, thank you for using U.S. steel.
You're welcome.
Now, the cookie cutters, you talk about how they're made. I saw a little video of the production of one. It's really fascinating. So tell us how a piece of steel, a round piece of steel, a ribbon of steel becomes one of these great cookie cutters.
Sure. So every cookie cutter, and we have about, I don't know, to be honest, I've lost count, someplace between 3,200 and 3,500 different shapes.
Oh, my gosh.
we have a bunch. Of that, we're probably running about 700 shapes really represent the core of our business.
Uh-huh.
So each cookie cutter has its own length. The metal comes off these big reels that automatically run through a machine, cut them to length, and they roll that hem on them and then roll them into a circle. And those just pop out and drop into a machine. Then we have individuals take this little ring and spot weld it so it's a ring. Right. Then it moves to a table, what we call our forming tables. Each cookie cutter has a die that we've built specifically for that cookie cutter. That's mounted to the table. They simply take the ring, put it on the table, hit a button, and it effectively bangs it into shape. And you can, if you look around the internet, you can find a bunch of videos of how that's done. Once it's made, then there's a choice of how it's going to be packaged. It might get a barcode label because it's going to end up in a store. It might be tied with a recipe card to go to a gift store. It might be put into a set of, say, three or four different shapes that will get sold online. So we don't really know. Or it might be a custom shape that's going to end up at a university or a store someplace, a business someplace. Currently, we're making about 25,000 cookie cutters a day, and we'll probably run 60 or 70 different shapes every day.
All made there in Rutland, Ben?
All made in Rutland. Hmm. We're about 55 people. We run from 7 in the morning to midnight.
I got to tell you, after watching that video, after I'm done this job, I think I want to come and be the person who puts that piece of steel on the machine and watch it bang it out and then take it off. It is the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. I could do that all day long and be happy.
Perfect.
But, you know, you talk about that it's comparable to what would be made in China. It wouldn't be cheaper, easier to move production abroad?
So this is funny, is, you know, when I joined the business and I was talking to all my business friends, they were like, why aren't you just buying this stuff from China? It would be so much easier. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure why I did it, but I felt that I'm like, we can make this in the U.S. and we should be able to figure out how to make this cheaper, which we did. And by doing that, it's the flexibility. You know, a great story we have is we got an e-blast from one of our competitors who manufactures in China that the llama was going to be their new shape. So we tooled up a llama ourselves. So we had our llama available on our website and on Amazon within 2 weeks. Well, getting stuff from China takes 3 months. Mm. By the time their product came over on the boat, we already owned the market for llama cookie cutters.
Wow.
Which is awesome.
That is fantastic.
When you're buying product from China, if you run out of something today, it's months to get it.
Yeah.
If we run out of something at 10 o'clock, we'll have it back in stock by 1.
Mm. Wow. That is that's an important fact that I don't think people ever really think about. So,
I mean, we look at these supply chain problems that everybody's having. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's because we're buying this stuff thousands of miles away. It's got to get on a boat. It's got to get unloaded at a port. It's got to get trucked across the country, blah, blah, blah. We just make it.
Touche.
Yeah.
Boy, I think of you and Darn Tough Socks and Twin Craft Soap here in Vermont that have figured it out, right, how to do the manufacturing here, keep it here in Vermont, hire Vermonters, and you know, definitely market the fact that it is Vermont made, it is American made, beautiful. Tell us about how the Clark family has been part of this business from the start, and I think there's a next generation involved.
Yeah, so my parents started it. My mom's an artist. My dad was a business guy, I think they started it because it was kind of neat. It was kind of someplace between a business and a hobby. And then I came along and I was like, you know, we were pregnant with our oldest daughter. And I was like, I'd like to move back to Vermont and raise my kids there. And I was sort of, Dad, how about you hire me? And he's like, we can't afford you. And I said, if you hire me, I'll solve that problem. So convinced them to come back. And actually my dad was sick. So it was sort of like, all right, come back to Rutland. We'll get to spend time together. He'll ultimately pass away, and I'll take over the country, over the business. Mm-hmm. On one hand, it's a sad story. On the other hand, it's brilliant because I got to spend a bunch of time with my dad while he was dying, which was great. You know, and it brought us back to Rutland, which was really, you know, really the drive. I grew up ski racing. I love to ski. Oh. I love to sail. I love to mountain bike, and that's what we do every day. Yesterday, I took the day off and skied in the morning and mountain biked in the afternoon, and we'll be sailing in a month. I mean, this is a fantastic place to live. Mm-hmm. And we can still service the world from here. I mean, we're selling cookie cutters in 19 countries.
Wow. Oh, Ben, this is brilliant. Are you a baker and a cookie maker yourself?
Not even remotely.
Thank you for your, refreshing honesty.
So, you know, when I came and looked at this, you know, when you're in business school, they talk about a widget being just this product, right? And I kind of look at cookie cutters a certain way that way. It's like we're making this product, you know, technologically, it's not a, you know, we're not making O-rings for the space shuttle. They're cookie cutters. It's really about the whole process from are we making the right product today and how do you sell the stuff? How do we connect with customers to want to buy our cookie cutters? You know, for example, there's a bunch of women out there referred to as cookiers. These are incredibly talented women who decorate cookies on a professional or sort of high amateur level. Thousands of them around the world. We've connected with a lot of these cookiers because we make cookie cutters. So when they're giving classes, we give them cookie cutters to use for the classes. They've designed shapes for us, which we sell and pay them a royalty. They've done videos for us and photographs for us. But when you see these amazing cookies on our website or on Instagram, cookiers have decorated this. And again, the talent is staggering. And we're like, they've got the talent. We know how to bend metal really fast. And it's been a great sort of marriage.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Ben, you mentioned you have somewhere between 3,200 and 3,500 different designs. I know you can't list them all as much as I'd love to hear them, but give us some of the categories of cookie cutters that you sell.
Sure. So the number one shape is the gingerbread boy. Not a huge surprise.
Right.
I think top three is the number one, like the shape of a one.
Oh.
And I think that's because when your oldest child turns one, their birthday party is like the largest event in the world, right?
Right.
And then when they turn two, we go, oh, was that this weekend? So we sell a lot of number ones. And then it's all over the place. I mean, for years, the starfish was huge. The mason jar was a big seller.
Really?
Snowflake does really well at Christmas.
Yeah.
The llamas were ginormous. I don't know why, but llamas were huge. and it just keeps keeps evolving. You know, the Christmas shapes are always, you know, gingerbread boy, star, snowflake, bell, angel. They always do well.
Yeah.
But then, you know, hearts at Valentine's Day, shamrocks at St. Patrick's Day. This is our final weekend where we're really seeing big Easter sales.
Oh, yeah.
So the egg, the chick, the bunny. Graduation will be pretty big. The mortarboard and the, I forget the other shape. Recently we started, you know, Discovery Channel does Shark Week every year.
Yes.
So we launched a bunch of shark cookie cutters, and they do great at Shark Week.
I was very impressed. I was going to bring that up. Like, we could have Shark Week celebrations with all your different cookie cutter designs. I'm a big fan of your tutu cookie cutter. I wondered if you have a favorite.
For years, mine was the bat.
Nice.
It was a really big cookie. I thought it was great, but it didn't sell very well, so it ultimately got discontinued.
Oh.
And then the running joke is my mom, who started the company, her favorite shape is the watering can. It does not sell very well, so sort of the joke is if the shape sells worse than the watering can, we discontinue it.
Sorry, Mom.
And then every year for my birthday, Jen, who's sitting here, makes me water and can cookies.
Oh, good for you, Jen. Well done.
Yeah.
So the next exciting thing I want to talk about is food coloring.
Okay.
So we were looking at, you know, everybody that buys cookie cutters, what else do they buy? And they bought food coloring. So we went to another company to make food coloring for us and just put our label on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought some and it sold out. We bought it again and it sold out. We bought it again and they couldn't get it because the caps or the tubes that it goes in came from China. So we couldn't get the product.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the math. We rented a space, built out a clean room, had a tube filling machine flown from Italy to come in here, and we're now manufacturing food coloring.
Oh, my goodness.
It's non-GMO, allergen-free. We think it's the best on the market because when we developed it, we bought all the top-selling food gel, food coloring gels on the market, mm-hmm. and we compared, you know, broke it down by color and sort of scientifically went at, well, who's got the best blue, who's got the best purple, who's got the best pink, who's got the best red, and we matched them all. So we have a great food coloring, and now we're making it as fast as we can. The tubes come from the U.S., you know, all the products come from the U.S., and we're making that here in Rutland also.
Oh, I love
so
this story.
So we're hoping to do this. Yeah.
I love it.
And it's the classic, you know, people talk about why do you make it here versus China. When there was a supply chain issue, we were sort of like, what do? Cry about it or let's just make our own. And that's what we've done.
All right, let's
head. People thought I was nuts for doing cookie cutters when we said we're going to build a facility to do food coloring. I got the equal look.
We're going to head to the land of the floating bridge. Let's talk to Ann in Brookfield. Hi, Ann.
Hello. I just wanted to ask. I have had this for a long, long time, and I kept it all together. I don't think I ever used it. I have actually a drawer of cookie cutters, mm-hmm. and this one has Ann Clark, Rutland, Vermont, and it has the complete recipe for gingerbread cookies because this is what the cutter is.
Mm-hmm.
This must be very old, right? One of your first
yes.
ones? Yeah.
Yes.
What year would that be?
Oh, that would have been, I'm going to think, 90, 91, maybe 80, not, probably 90, 91.
So the very early days of the company.
Yeah, and it's yeah. and it's also tied with a little furry string, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yep. If it's one of the original gingerbread men, then we actually had an error in the recipe.
Oh, no.
So if you bake it and it doesn't come out perfectly, it is one of the first ones we did.
Ben, what's the error? Did they forget to put in sugar? Or what?
No, I don't remember what it was, but it was before I got to the company and somebody had complained about, hey, this doesn't come out right. And I think like while my mom was writing out the, you know, the recipe on the card, I think she got a phone call or got interrupted or something and skipped an ingredient. I don't remember what it was.
Human error. Hey, I want to talk to you about the state cookie cutters. I feel I have to speak up for Michiganders who have to buy two separate cookie cutters to make their whole state. Now, props to you for having the UP, the Upper Peninsula cookie cutter. But,
yes.
but poor Michiganders have to spring for a second cookie cutter to do their entire state.
They do. They do. You know, states are funny because every state wants it, but the only people that want to buy a Michigan cookie cutter are the people from Michigan.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. We kept our Vermont state cookie cutter, even though we don't sell that many of them.
Yeah. And there's some out west where, like, I think Wyoming, Colorado, you could just say, same one. You just keep producing
exactly.
that same, rectangle there. Who is
right.
whipping up these creative designs for all these cookie cutters?
Oh, it's a combination. We have a creative director. We work with a bunch of the cookiers who are constantly giving us suggestions. And then we're looking at what's selling in the market. You know, we're combing Google and we're combing Amazon. We're combing competitors' websites to say what shapes seem to be selling well. And then that's what we launch.
Yeah. Now, from watching the videos of people making it, it looks like people are really enjoying and having a lot of fun working there at Ann Clark. So why is cookie cutter making something that people are enjoying doing for a living?
We've really worked hard to make this a fun place to work. You know, I mean, it's really simple. It's what our parents taught us. You know, treat people the way you'd want to be treated. Mm-hmm. Be nice, be honest, be forward. Let's have a clean workspace. You know, let's make it a low stress environment. You know, we're going to come in, we're going to work hard, we're going to make cookie cutters, but let's be as happy as we can. And it really comes down to, of all things, hire good people. If you hire good people, it's easy. And if you have bad people, suggest they leave work someplace else. But we have a phenomenal crew. Everybody's excited, and that sort of feeds off of each other. Mm-hmm. When you come into work and everybody says, good morning, how are you? Hey, it's raining today. Is that going to be okay? They really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And it makes it fun, you know. As the CEO, my biggest challenge is remembering everybody's name. So I can say, hi, Jen, or hi, Bob. And that's important.
Yeah.
We're trying to create a family here, and I think people appreciate it.
Well, it is also neat to be able to say, I make cookie cutters for a living. Now, you have a lot of great recipes, cookie recipes on the website, even recipes for dog treats. I trust these have now been proofread to make sure that all the proper ingredients are listed on the website.
Yeah, we actually hired somebody to do that. We said we need somebody not here to take each recipe, make it exactly to the recipe, and makes it, you know, to make sure it's real. We did the dog biscuits at home with my girls when they were little, and as we're feeding them to our Labrador retrievers, we realized it doesn't really matter what they taste like because the labs will eat anything. So, again, we sent those out and had somebody else. We actually had a vet look at them to make sure they're healthy for the dogs, and then we had a couple of people, you know, sort of do the recipes to say, yeah, this actually works.
Yeah, that's great. We're almost out of time, Ben. I'm loving this, but is there a shape of a cookie cutter that you want made that the design team hasn't created yet?
I do. There's a sale. We sail up in Lake Champlain in the summer. We sail Etchells, and I want to have an Etchell sailboat made, but I haven't been able to get that on the docket yet. But it's coming.
All right.
Eventually I'll say, hey, I want this cookie cutter.
And hopefully it sells more than the watering can. Ben Clark is
the whole thing.
Ben Clark is the CEO of Ann Clark Cookie Cutters, and you can check out their cookie cutter designs at AnnClarkCookieCutters.com. Ben, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rick. This was great. Have a great day.
All right, you too. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get the update, and then we'll be back to hear some wonderful baseball memories from Carl Lindholm. And coming up today at 11, Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. It doesn't matter that opening day got batted backwards by labor negotiations. It does not matter that the Cincinnati Reds don't officially open the Major League Baseball season anymore following a parade through downtown, although I did love that tradition. What matters is that the season gets started today. And I've got the perfect guest to share some of his baseball experiences with us to put us in the mood for that first shout of play ball. Carl Lindholm is a sports columnist for the Addison County Independent, is an emeritus dean of advising and assistant professor of American Studies, and he's also an authority on Negro League baseball. Carl Lindholm, it is great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, Rick, it's great to be back with you.
Now, to ask Carl a question about his baseball memories, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Carl, just back in Vermont. Where have you been lately?
Well, I got back yesterday. I shook off a little pandemic rust and you know, got out of the March doldrums, and I drove to Florida to watch some baseball. And the first thing I discovered is that some people prefer to fly long distances, and I'm beginning to understand why that is. And I got back yesterday just in time to watch a Middlebury baseball game against Union, Middlebury White.
Mm-hmm.
My main reason to go, and I've done this for many years in a number of locations, is to follow the Middlebury baseball team. The pandemic kind of interrupted that. I taught baseball classes, so I often had some student baseball team members in my class, so I had a kind of an interest in the players themselves on the team. And it took me to Tucson and to California and to Florida in a time when it's good to get out of Vermont. So I saw five Middlebury baseball games, and then I actually caught a couple more. I caught a game at JetBlue. I wanted to go to JetBlue and see the Red Sox park down there in Fort Myers, and I had a chance to do that too. So I'm just back.
Well, welcome back. Now, the Middlebury Games, where were they played down in Florida?
Well, this is the wonderful thing. They're played in Central Florida at a number of locations, but primarily in Winter Haven at Channel Lakes Park.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have some old people listening, you'll remember that in the 1980s, the Red Sox trained at Channel Lakes Park in Winter Haven, and then after them, the Indians.
Yep.
In the 1980s, I found myself for a few years single, and a friend and I went down and watched spring training a couple of times. And then I married a woman who was a baseball fan, and we actually spent something of a honeymoon in the Tampa area, going to ball games at the Red Sox games, and a number of teams are congested around that area.
Mm.
So it was a nostalgic trip for me to watch Middlebury in this park where I had seen the Red Sox train, and where I actually in the 1980s got a chance to hang out with Ted Williams at the lower field. Now, don't think that Ted Williams befriended me. I was in Ted Williams' presence.
Okay.
For games. But it's a nice nostalgic trip for me this time to see the Middlebury Club in the park where I saw the Red Sox years ago.
Yeah, so I used to follow minor league baseball pretty religiously, too, and the Red Sox had a Florida State League team, the Winter Haven Red Sox, who played at Chain of Lakes Park. I always thought it was the most romantic-sounding park.
Yes.
So tell us about what the park is like.
Well, the park is not like it was in the 1980s. It's the way spring training was when spring training was great.
Yeah.
Where you could just walk up to the window and get a ticket.
Right.
And small parks, not necessarily in major Florida cities. The contrast between JetBlue is a modern park. I think it has about, I should know, but it has a 10 or 12,000 seats.
Mm.
You know, Winter Haven has half that by at least.
Yeah.
And the park is a little bit run down, as you might expect. There are no major league teams there now. And so that's actually all of these teams in the Northeast who take spring trips south. There's an operation, a concept that you just say you're coming down for this week. And this operation takes the teams that are down there from northern colleges and makes up a schedule.
Oh, wow.
The Red Sox played teams from Wisconsin and Minnesota, and they played some eastern teams. Some teams actually in our conference played against Bowdoin and Trinity. Colby was down there. And so it's kind of nice. You get to see a lot of different Division III teams. But
yeah.
It's a nice setting, but it's quite different from, say, the Yankees Park in Tampa or the Red Sox Park. And nowadays, to get a ticket to the Red Sox game, you have to write ahead.
Yep.
In fact, the greatest accomplishment of mine for the week, very quickly, was I got into the game with a picture of my ticket on my phone.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Welcome to 2022, Carl Lindholm. Hey, I do want, before we jump onto any other subject, I do want to hear, though, even though you said you didn't, you know, he didn't befriend you. Ted Williams, one of the greatest players of all time, people forget about the incredible military service, flying 39 missions during the Korean War. As a matter of fact, Carl, one thing I learned last night as I was getting ready for this, I did not know that over half of his missions were flown with future astronaut and U.S. Senator John Glenn. But tell us about, you know, what your time was like with Teddy Ballgame.
Well, John Glenn always said how pleased he was to fly with a famous person like Ted Williams. It was great. I went with a friend, a real baseball fan, and we stayed in Winter Haven. And we went to the, and we really were taking the baseball cure. And we went to watch the baseball Red Sox farm teams train in the morning, because that's where Ted Williams was, a little inside baseball. Ted Williams would approve very much of the way batters hit the ball today with an uppercut swing. The Red Sox, the prevailing theory of hitting a baseball then I won't go into this at this, I promise, was the Charlie Lau theory. The Red Sox had a hitting coach named Walt Riniak. And that, his theory was to hit down on the ball and hit line drives. And Ted Williams wanted to hit the ball in the air. So Ted Williams never went to the upper field and worked with the major leaguers. So he just sat with Johnny Pesky in a golf cart, or he talked to players down there. And we just, we were kind of witnessing Ted Williams. He did talk to us. We were the guys from Vermont. I'm sure he thought we were gay. That was okay with us. You know, with these two guys from Vermont, they're out here every morning. You know, and he was happy to sign autographs. He was not pleasant. I mean, he's not. He was not a jolly guy. He was not unpleasant. But for me to say I made friends with Ted Williams would be wrong. But it was kind of fun because he was my hero growing up. And I think, you know, you mentioned the five. He lost five seasons, and you imagine what his numbers would be with those five seasons in his prime. So I think he's legitimately the greatest hitter who ever played.
Got to agree with you. And, of course, he had a home here in southern Vermont down around Brattleboro. So he had that Vermont connection. Did you pick
up? Beck was from Burlington.
Sorry. Oh, that's right. You are correct.
Exactly.
Yeah. Has your hitting been better since spending time down there with Teddy?
My hitting was never good. I was a pitcher. I had an alibi. I was a pretty good bunter. But no, and in high school, I told people I could hit bad pitching pretty well. But if you put a decent pitcher on the mound and he threw me a curveball, I was in trouble.
Yeah. Now, I know you played basketball at Middlebury. Did you also play baseball?
Yeah, I did. In a very different time. You know, I Middlebury brought 37 players down to Winter Haven. And they need all these pitchers. They play 10 games or so in 7 days. And we used to have about 15 players. We only played a 15-game schedule. We had one spring trip, and we went to Connecticut. the season was later. We played Connecticut and Boston, and we played West Point. And went to UConn and got no hit. But it was later in the year. We played our games in May because the class year was longer. But much more modern. We had one coach. He had no assistant. So I look at the, and you look at the places where Middlebury team gets to train these days in the new field house, and it's entirely different. But it's a nice, you know, the uniforms still look the same. They still say Middlebury on the front.
Yeah,
I make that connection.
There you go. Touche. So Mid is back at Forbes Field, not in Pittsburgh, but in Middlebury this Saturday. Doubleheader against the White Mules. I think they just go by the Mules now of Colby. Carl, is there any connection between Mid's Forbes Field and the old home of the Pittsburgh Pirates?
No. my coach when I was at Middlebury was Wendy Forbes. And when we were building a new field, the new field we're on now, one of his classmates said that I will help fund the field if you name it after my classmate, Wendy Forbes. So that's the nature of it.
Forbes Field. I love it. So it is opening day. Do you have any interesting opening day stories?
Well, I do. I actually have an opening day experience, which was very thrilling. I taught school and went to graduate school in Cleveland from 1970 to 1976 and coached the baseball team when I was at that school. And then in Cleveland, I thought it was, I think it was citywide, but maybe just at the school where I taught. If you had a ticket to opening day with the Indians then, you could get out of school to go to the game. And so I was a baseball coach, and I threw about a dozen of my players in a van, and we went down to opening day in 1975 in Cleveland. Now, Rick, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you know what's special about opening day in Cleveland in 1975?
I've got to think about it, but what's funny is the only opening day game I've ever been to was in Cleveland, Ohio, and it was probably just about 4 or 5 years after that. But in 75, I was a 15-year-old kid. Go ahead.
The first black manager in Major League Baseball
Frank
was
Robinson.
Also named Robinson.
Yeah, Frank Robinson.
Frank Robinson, of course, the very, very great Frank Robinson.
Yeah.
And he was a manager, started in his first year in Cleveland in 1975, and he was a player manager, though he didn't play much.
That's right.
And Cleveland had this awful stadium that I loved. Tickets were cheap, and you could always move down to the front row.
Yep.
But He batted himself second, and so we had 75,000 people at the game.
Wow.
Sold out. He batted him freezing. He's freezing out, by the way. He batted himself second in the lineup, and he hit a home run in the first inning.
Wow.
And the place went wild. So that's a little factoid that Frank Robinson, first black manager, hit a home run in his first at-bat as a manager.
Wow.
And I hadn't been to a lot of great famous games, but that was one that I was at. So
yeah, and he started his career in Ohio, but with the other Ohio team, the Cincinnati Reds, was National League Rookie of the Year, but really made his career with the Baltimore Orioles, teammate of Brooks Robinson. So to carry on with that Robinson theme, but that is a special day. And
well, Frank Robinson is, I think, not as well known as some, but I think in Joe Posnanski's top 100 players, he was in the top 15 of all time.
Yeah, well, should be for anyone who saw him play back in the day. That's...
Now, can I tell you another opening day story?
Please do, yeah.
The column I'm working on in The Independent is going to be on opening day 1946, not even opening day 1946 for Jackie Robinson when he's playing for the Royals in Jersey City, which was a great day, 1940. But opening day at spring training for Jackie Robinson in 1946, his first spring training time. Can you imagine what his spring training was like in Florida, who was still was Jim Crowland, legal separation in Florida.
Yeah.
And the Dodgers trained at Daytona Beach. And so I took a side trip to Daytona Beach to the park where Jackie Robinson played. It's not really the park, it's the site where the park was.
Gotcha.
In 1946, it was City Island Park in Daytona Beach, and now it's called Jackie Robinson Park. And it's been renovated in 1999. It's a shiny, beautiful park with Jackie Robinson, not memorabilia, but Jackie Robinson representations all around the park. They call it Jackie Robinson Ballpark and Museum. It's just a wonderful, wonderful representation. So that was a topical and fun side trip for me to Daytona Beach to see Jackie Robinson ballpark.
I love it. Well, Carl, he then played AAA ball up just north of us with the Montreal Royals. Is there any kind of special commemoration up there that, you know, we can go see?
I'm sure there is. What I'd like to, his opening day, opening day 1947, which we celebrate next Friday, for example, all the time, was a little anticlimactic. Everybody knew Jackie Robinson had made the Dodgers, and he had played for the Dodgers for a year in the farm system. The opening day, his 1946 in Jersey City for the Royals, for the Montreal Royals, he went 4-for-5. He had scored 4 runs, had 4 RBIs, stole 2 bases, hit a home run, as I said, and he scored 2 of his runs on box by the pitcher. Now, we don't have time to explain the box, but he so unnerved the pitcher with his daring, you know, feints and off third base that the pitcher interrupted his delivery, and he came home twice. So that was the opening day that was so spectacular in 1946. So I think that was – and then Montreal that year, he was 26 years old. He was ready for the major leagues, but this sociological experiment of trying to acclimate whites and blacks playing together was required in the mind of Branch Rickey that he spend a year in Montreal.
Yeah.
But Montreal won the division, the International League, the best minor league division league in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
They won their league by 18.5 games.
Oh, wow.
And Jackie Robinson batted .349. So very clear he was ready for the major leagues, but he was held back to this for reasons that people thought appropriate and may have been. And now, if you remember, 12 weeks after Jackie Robinson played for the Dodgers in 1947, Bill Veeck brought up from the Newark Eagles Larry Doby.
Yes.
And he put him right on the team.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And so it's a wonderful kind of contrast and a really interesting debate, because Larry Doby had a tough adjustment in 47. He might have been. He might have benefited from a little time in the minors, just acclimating to the social requirements of integration at that point.
Well, interesting that you bring that up. I was going to mention Dobie because I never want him to be forgotten because he had to break the color barrier in the American League, going to different cities than Jackie was going to. Yes. But as you mentioned, he came up with the Cleveland Indians, so they broke the American League color barrier and then hired the first black manager. So how about now the Cleveland Guardians, that franchise, for making those two moves, you know, in their history?
Well, I love the Indians, the Guardians, and they have Terry Francona as their manager, and he loves it there. They have they just signed one of their good ball players, which is unusual to a big contract because they have one of the smallest payrolls in all of baseball.
Yeah,
which is actually what about the baseball lockout was all about. It's just there are five teams that have a payroll. Somebody said they have a payroll less than Max Scherzer or somebody else. A couple of teams have a payroll. Higher than the Orioles have a payroll less than individual players on the rich teams.
Yeah. Anyway. We've got a minute left. I want to mention this. A few years ago, I was at Fenway, you threw out the first pitch. So what did you throw? Did you throw your heater, some junk, a Bill Lee Ephus pitch? What did you mix them up with there, man?
You were there?
I was there.
Oh, my goodness. I thought it was going to happen a half hour before the game, and there would be three people in the stands. It was pretty good. What I threw, the only thing I threw at age 70-something, my whole goal was not to bounce it.
Right.
And I didn't bounce it as Euchre would say. It was a little bit outside.
Bob Euchre. I could go on about Euchre. I was a Phillies fan when we got him, and when we would be driving and listening to a game on the radio, and if Euchre stepped up, honest to goodness, my brothers and I, we'd all be like, oh no, Euchre. He was that bad.
Euchre was a catcher.
Yeah.
And he said his best skill, he knew how to catch a knuckleball.
A lot
of catchers can't do it. He says, I just chase it back to the screen and pick it up.
That's brilliant. Carl Lindholm's sports column appears in the Addison County Independent. They're always fun and informative. Carl, great talking baseball with you this morning. Go Sox.
Anytime, Rick. Go
Sox as well. All right. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. And feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of the Vermont Viewpoint podcast by downloading it at wdevradio.com. And it is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk with Bob Ney, and we have our spring migration bird show.